one of the things I think that's really useful about philosophy as a tool is it encourages you to sort of think through the way that you try and assign categorical determinations, like sure. what is consciousness
or thought,
yeah. right? Yeah. And it obviously depends what you think that is, where you're prepared to draw that line. But for me, consciousness is something ubiquitous.
That's Jason Tuckwell, the author of Creation and the Function of Art, Techne Poesis and the Problem of Aesthetics. It was published by Bloomsbury in late 2017. In this chat, we talk about his book. And we also talk about making art, autopoiesis, consciousness, biology, and psychedelics. Before we go any further, I just want to play a clip from the end of our conversation, which hopefully gives you some useful context for what you're about to hear.
One of my motivations in having these types of conversations is that there's this really important aspect of knowledge that is produced through conversation, right? You know,
absolutely.
And it goes to everything that we've been talking about, right? Mm. You know, that we can sit down and we both do. We can sit down and write our essays or whatever, our books.
Yep.
And that's important. But there are a whole set of other possibilities that crop up when you have two people
Chatting
to one another.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. I can't agree more. You know, it's the model of joint authorship is not synthetic.
Mm. Yeah.
Only.
Yeah.
If we take seriously what we've been talking about, there's an autopoetic element absolutely. That emerges that is not reducible to some sort of combination of two.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's a co-creation.
Correct.
Yeah.
If you're watching the YouTube version of this chat, you'll notice the slightly weird camera angle. This is what happens when you don't have anyone behind the camera. Hopefully that won't stop you from enjoying our conversation. And hopefully there'll be more of this type of conversation in the future. So please do like and subscribe and all that kind of stuff.
I thought we could start with a little bit of an introduction.
Yep.
So I'll introduce myself. I'm Ben Denham, and I'm an artist and writer and maker of strange machines. And you are Jason Tuckwell, and you released a book. You had a book come out, actually, at the end of last year.
That's correct.
And it's called Creation and the Function of Art.
That's correct.
And the subtitle is?
Techne Poesis and the Problem of Aesthetics.
Yeah. Hmm. So, and I guess, you know, I just thought as well in terms of bio, we could talk a little bit about our shared bio.
Yes, indeed. We have a shared bio.
We have a shared bio, yeah.
So, before we talk about the biome,
So let's start with the bio and then get onto the biome.
Yeah.
So we both went to UWS art school when it still had an art school back in the good old days.
Alumni?
Yes, and we're both also alumni of Writing and Society.
Yep.
And the Writing and Society Research Centre at Western Sydney University, as it is now known. Mm. And I thought I'd bring this up because I'm interested in how you go from art school to writing a book that is basically, it's a work of philosophy, right? Is it a work of philosophy?
the simple communicative answer is yes. The more complicated and I sometimes feel self-conscious in talking about it in this way is that it's not explicitly a work of philosophy. It is situated within a philosophical, with certain philosophical contexts, but it's about technique. And the argument there is that certain insights about how knowledge production informs activities, certain philosophical modes exemplify that, and those technical practices are everywhere at work to make philosophy possible. So there are certain insights that go across mathematics, philosophy, and artistic practice. And I think the divisions where they exist are at the level of technique and at the level of how particular actions occur, I guess I would say I think we're missing some things there. And that work was an attempt to think through that.
Sure. So how do you get from, like, what line would you trace from art school to writing that work?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the informal response, I guess, would be that I sort of feel like I've always been doing the same project. So I guess in that sense was, and I think, whether I think that it's a conscious decision or not, I mean, I think when you're engaged in an art making practice, you have to grapple with process. How do you make work of art? And the subtitle that says "The Problem of Aesthetics" is to say there's a problem with aesthetics as a field, because what I think it misses is the work of art. And this was a key idea that the book tried to explore, which is essentially aesthetics gets us to treat works of art as artifacts, as completed objects. And what we do in the process is we miss, and what we do then is we miss the process. And I think this is also the case in something like performance works, where we sort of view the performance itself as like as a product. And what we miss in that process, I think, is an opportunity to interrogate what creativity really is. And I think the reason we miss that is because, and this will sound strange to say, but I think creativity is fundamentally opposed to originality. And in that sense, I think there's a bit of conflation that goes on between the two. And if you sort of, and I found when you make that move and you try to follow through on that, would mean you find that creativity is something that's opposed to anything original. And hence one of the major conflations in the history of the way we try to think through art when we try to, and this is certainly nothing new. I mean, we've known about this for a long time now, and a lot of those really important counter critiques around modernism has shown that, you know, we don't believe in the idea of the sort of originary creative genius. And, you know, then there's this whole sort of, that leads on to that sort of post-structural view, I guess, or structuralist view first, that everything is a sort of pastiche. But that's not creativity either. What that does is it destroys the idea of originality by saying everything already exists. And the origin, you can't approach the idea of creativity or resolve it as a thing, in my view, by resolving the idea of originality into something already existent, or the always already, or any of those forms of prior existence. And what you, the only way you can do that then is that you say creativity doesn't exist. And what you say is it's a sort of artifact itself of earlier ways of thinking through existence that have a sort of theological origin. And that's the sort of, and we know this is another familiar philosophical trope from at least Nietzsche onwards earlier, that this is the sort of death of God thing, right? And one of the consequences of that is there is no creativity, or there is no originality. I have a very different view of that, which is essentially, and I'll wrap this up really quickly, that creativity is something that emerges in practice, and it's a type of work.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And that's it.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess this is this goes to, you know, I guess our shared interests in the relationship of art to biology, right? Because we when we're thinking about work and practice, these are ideas that we can extend to other organisms.
Yeah, that's certainly what I feel like it opens up, and it has to. And I guess what it opens up first is that sort of demarcation where we are the only things that are capable of that sort of level of technical intervention. And I particularly choose the idea of the technical there because this is the root term for art. You know, there are two root etymological ways to trace our modern conception of art. One is poesis, which is the origin, how everything comes to be. And the other is techne, which is technique, how you make things, and specifically how you make things change. And what we have done historically is that, and you see this very clearly when you look at the link of the term artificial, which is closely linked to the idea of techne, that you see that this is something that we reserve exclusively for the human species. It's, and in some sense, it's a very definitive mark of the human species. And I think our shared interest in this that we're clearly seeing is that's demonstrably false. I mean, there a number of emergent scientific avenues from biology and systems theory and ecology and a whole host of others, in fact, that just simply is not the case.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess kind of coming back to where my original question, which was kind of thinking about how does this relate to our experience at art school, you know, and because I think, you know, to me, you know, like I think in the popular imagination, there may be a little bit of a disconnect between what we're talking about here and you know, art practice, right? Mm. If we think of art as, you know, the painter in his studio, yeah, and it's usually him, right?
You know, yes, of course. Yeah. The genius asshole in his studio.
The genius asshole in his studio, yeah. So, but I think, you know, I think to me, you know, one of the connections that I would make back to our experience, and I don't presume to speak for both of us, but I think I can be fairly confident on this count, is that there was a really clear sense that ideas were part of the materials that we were working with, and you know that you know materials are not just the paints or the canvas or the things that you sculpt stuff out of, but ideas are a material in art making, and in some way by being curious, by being a curious individual and someone who wants to learn about all these different fields, you're kind of cultivating the ground out of which the art emerges. Mm. So, you know, and I think that, you know, that to me is very much, you know, how I think about, you know, the kinds of my interest in biology at the moment is like that this is, that while this may not turn into an artwork directly, mm-hmm. it's about like it's like preparing the soil, you know.
I completely agree with that in the sense that I think that the very unique environment that was at WSU as an art school at the time, which very much pioneered a conceptual approach, but a rigorous conceptual approach. I think there are valid criticisms or ways to think through that the sort of downplaying of technical education in art schools has its problems, and I think that's true, and I think you can see that in contemporary arts in certain instances. But I think the really important thing is, and I think what's very, and we have a great affinity in our shared practice about this, is that I would also regard my theoretical output now as a continuation of the same work problems that I was trying to work through in a visual arts context. And obviously they're very different. In terms of the sorts of outcomes that they have, but they have the same sorts of central. There's a thematic concern there, mm-hmm. and that thematic concern is about. I take seriously that art has, and I'm not afraid to use this word, as some people in philosophy are. I think that art has metaphysical dimensions. Mm-hmm. I will clearly state that I don't think that they're transcendent or that has anything theological about it, but there is a certain, it is, to me, I take, let me just sum it up very quickly. Art is a serious problem. How art is possible, to me, is a serious question. And it's a question that can't be answered philosophically. If it could, then art would have given way to philosophy a long time ago.
so what's there that I mean, I guess I mean, one of the things that we're hopefully going to talk a little bit about is psychedelics, and
I also have experience with psychedelics.
how strange for two artists who have taken psychedelics. How odd.
I should have signed some sort of disclaimer thing. But we're talking about art. This could just be fiction.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah. But I think that, you know, there is one of the things that is often said about the psychedelic experience is that it has an ineffable quality. And I'm interested in thinking about like the relationship between art and psychedelics and practices with psychedelics, and also the experience of the qualities that actually, how do we approach the psychedelic experience? And I think, you know, in some ways, some of the tools that we get from studying art can be useful in dealing with a field of experience that is largely and often ineffable, right? So,
yes,
you know, I think there are these kind of parallels between those things.
Yes.
So, I guess, I mean, maybe we should talk a little bit about biology.
Mm.
I mean, because this plays a part in your book as well, right?
It does. The third chapter of the book, there are big chapters sometimes. I think maybe one of the mistakes I made was making very big chapters. But anyway, the third section deals particularly with biology, yeah.
Yeah. So what, I mean, how do autopoietic organisms fit into this, you know, and what is the relationship between like an organism that makes itself and this process of making art?
Yeah. Okay. So for me, the autopoietic paradigm is crucial. And the reason the autopoietic paradigm is crucial is because that's a way to get out of the binary between or the bind of the origin and or of the eternal, something that's already been there. And what I mean by that is this. Logically, in the order of causation, we have a certain thing that I would call a certain unidirectionality, right? Which means whatever's original produces an effect. So the cause-effect relationship is one way. So it's absurd to think that if I've caused something, then that effect can determine me in any way. And classical causation relies on this principle to a certain extent, largely in the way that it deals with processes. And that's how we, and for me, this is very evident in the work of art, because this is how we resolve the idea that there's somebody creatively working away and that they produce a work of art. And therefore, we can conflate that person and we get all these strange effects that come out of that. There's an artistic genius who's a person who's created an object. What I think that we miss in that process is that there is something autopoietic that occurs that mediates between the two, and that cannot be accounted for in either. So autopoiesis then, and I take the idea directly from Maturana and Varela, who are the people who one of the first to formulate it as a concept. Mm-hmm. And from that, what it means is recursive causation. Mm-hmm. So it challenges the idea that something is produced, i.e. in this case whether it's a single cell organism or whether it's a plant or it's an animal or it's a human being, what it means is what they are capable of doing and what they are capable of acting is not determined by the original causes that brought it into being. So this has profound consequences for what you think nature is. Because when we try and think through nature, it's a very one of those big, difficult ideas that we sort of treat it as though it's something determinate, and there are so many different versions of what you think that is and applies to. But one of the telling ways in this is when we talk about something like my nature. Mm-hmm. You know, what sort of, it's, you know, I behave a certain way because of my nature, right? Autopoiesis fundamentally disputes that idea by saying that, number one, there's a sort of causal break between the conditions that determine me. So the reason that I'm not just a synthesis of my parents is because I can think for myself. Now, that's a serious problem. How is that possible if you take that classical view of causality? That's why I think that autopoiesis is a necessary concept, and it's a necessary phenomena to acknowledge. And once you do that, you know, this is, you know, I sound like a Lamarckian. That's okay by me. You know, like, you know, I mean, I think his example of the, you know, the classical example of the giraffe was probably wrong, but... Yeah. We know there are epigenetic effects. Mm. They're still disputed. Let's be honest about this in terms of the science. There are hardcore, you know, genetic determinists who think epigenetics is rubbish, and it might prove to be the case. But it's irrelevant in the sense that, you know, in all sorts of fields, like in consciousness research or something, you know, there is a supplementary dimension that emerges from original conditions that is irreducible to the conditions themselves. I want to say a further step to that, and this is one of the core arguments of the book, is that there's a consequence of that. It causes a change in the order of causation. Mm. And this is Lamarck's crime.
Right.
Because Lamarck says not only is there a secondary order, but it affects the primary one.
Yes. Right. And this is where you draw on the example of cyanobacteria.
That's correct.
Yeah. So the point being that these creatures created the first pollution crisis.
The first
in the history of the planet, which was by oxygenating the
atmosphere. You're a much more sophisticated account of that. I'm a slightly cartoonish.
Well, I think we draw the pictures that kind of suit our arguments. That are sufficient, right, to the argument, yeah. Right? Yeah. And I think, you know, like, you know, I think it is really important to recognize, though, isn't it? You know, that there are these creatures who develop this ability to use sunlight for energy, and then as a byproduct of that, and this is the kind of second generation of photosynthesizing organisms, because the first generation didn't actually use water as a source of hydrogen, but the second generation did.
Yep.
And once they started using water as their hydrogen source, they released all this oxygen into the atmosphere, right?
Yeah.
And so then you have... Well, yeah, what was the first great pollution crisis? Because most organisms were evolved in anoxic conditions and couldn't tolerate the oxygen, and a lot of them died, you know, due to the oxygen being released by photosynthesis. So you've got these organisms that fundamentally changed the conditions of emergence, right? And absolutely. Then and from that point onwards, there's this cascading series of changes, right, that happen. So you go from an oxygenated atmosphere to organisms that use oxygen in their metabolism, right? Correct. And suddenly, you know, as soon as organisms can use oxygen in their metabolism, suddenly they unleash huge amounts of energy that weren't there previously.
Correct.
So, and then those, some of those organisms that can use oxygen in their metabolism and have this, you know, because it's combustible, right? We know that. We know oxygen is combustible, right? So
extra electrons.
Yeah, yeah. So you have all of this extra energy that can be produced once you can incorporate it into your metabolism. And then some of those bacteria that develop this trick of using oxygen in their metabolism get incorporated into the eukaryotic cell, right? So, and that they're our mitochondria, right? Yes. So that's the mitochondria that we have in our cells now. Mm-hmm. So you can trace a line from the photosynthesizing bacteria that release the oxygen to our evolution, right? That,
absolutely. The evolution of our bodies.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
And I think you can go further.
Mm.
You have to be careful how you do it. Mm. And there are, we must, and we should be very mindful of not anthropomorphizing these conditions, because we don't want to say that they're, and we've talked about this before, and as I will just repeat what you've stated very clearly and importantly, it's not a case of talking about primitive forms of life in this regard. There are differences, and I would argue that there's a difference in complexity as part of one of the consequences of that. And what I guess I want to say out of that is that the consequence of increased complexity is the ability to do more things,
yeah,
to have a greater effect.
Sure.
So I don't, and just to make it clear about what I'm trying to say, this in the context of the cyanobacteria. The cyanobacteria, as far as I, but people will say, and would be right to say, you can't say that the cyanobacteria decide to, or they have an intentional idea to, you know, to have a massive pollution event that terraforms the Earth. Right, they're not going, we want to make multicellular bodies so we can have more power. Okay, right? They're not doing that. What I think they are, what I think nevertheless is the case, is within the locality of their bodies and their beings that have created or function through a differentiation between an interior environment that for very broadly constitutes a sort of functional self and an exterior environment that includes others and more general forces of the Earth and of the cosmos, that their actions have consequences. They don't understand what they are, but they are trying to act.
Mm.
That, I think, is enough.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that is enough. You know, that there are actions with consequences. I think the other thing that you said that sticks out in my mind is that what we head towards, like it you know, I think it is wrong to talk about, you know, primitive or simple organisms, because all of these all bacteria are incredibly complex once you start looking at their physiology. You know, just ask a microbiologist. But I think what you do have is that you have conglomerations of cells that can do more, right? Mm. You know, and I think this is present from, you know, and I think that's a really useful way of thinking about it that you described, that you have these things, that you have these communities of cells that can do more than single cells alone. And yes. I think this is actually present in bacteria in relation to quorum sensing, particularly. Yep. You know, so if you, as a bacterial cell, if you can produce a molecule and release that into your environment, and if your fellow bacteria, your kind, your species, can pick up on that molecule and sense how many of their kind are around, then you have the basis for collective action, right? So, and this is what quorum sensing basically is you know, bacteria producing a molecule that they then pick up on in the environment to be able to tell how many of their kind are around and to know then intelligently when to be able to trigger collective action, right? Because there's no point in doing collective action if you don't know that you've got enough people around to carry it off, right?
Right.
Or enough fellow cells around in this case. Right.
And here's where the power of the concept of autopoiesis really comes into play, I think, once you start to try and think it through in these contexts. Autopoiesis is not something that just happens at the level of totality of any body. It happens progressively. So you have at the level of the eukaryotic simplest, or, you know, the least complicated cellular arrangement, it reaches a sort of critical mass of something. We don't know why and what the conditions are, but it's an observable fact that this happens. And then a higher order organization emerges and reconfigures the particulars into a certain sort of unity. Now, between the eukaryotic cell and us, the eukaryotic cell doesn't have one kind of autopoiesis and we have another. We are composed of billions of singular cells, each with an autopoietic emergence that's specific to them. Then our bodies are organized into structures, and each of those have an autopoietic emergence that belongs to them. And let me give a very high order example, but I think they must happen in many orders. So the higher order example here would be the gastrointestinal system. Mm-hmm. Now, we know this now that the gastrointestinal system has something like an order of a number of neurons or quantity of neurons that's somewhat analogous to a cat's brain or something. It functions autonomously. And when we say autonomously, we have to be very careful, because I think what we tend to throw towards in that idea is that it's a mechanism. I think that's wrong. I think it's an autopoietic emergence. It's an intelligible thing. If I could try and be a bit, just to pull back on the thinking thing a little bit, just to make sure we're not anthropomorphizing in that sense, that maybe there is something probably distinctive about, there's definitely something distinctive about our brains. And it might be thought.
Yeah.
You know, thought as objective thought. And what I mean by that is that an intelligible process that can make representations and impressions from the world and treat them as another order through which to organize.
Abstraction.
On top of which, or as a result of which, another order of autopoiesis emerges, which is probably self-consciousness.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, because I think this question of consciousness is important, right? Because
very,
yeah, and
I'm comfortable to say that goes a long way, because it depends on your and I mean, one of the things I think that's really useful about philosophy as a tool is that it encourages you to sort of think through the way that you try and assign categorical determinations, like what is consciousness
or thought
and it obviously depends what you think that is, where you're prepared to draw that line, but for me consciousness is something ubiquitous.
So because I did and I think you might have even included this passage in your book.
I should have put a thank you note to you in there, because you drew my attention to this.
Well, I mean, this is a really powerful definition of consciousness, right?
Absolutely.
And this is from What Is Life by Lynn Margulis and Dorian Sagan. Consciousness, a private affair, is not directly measurable, but an ability to render a quality measurable is no reason to assume its absence, to assume that animals are mere instinct machines. Indeed, we would take Griffin a step further. Not just animals are consciousness, but every organic being, every autopoietic cell is conscious.
In the simplest sense, consciousness is an awareness of the outside world, and this world need not be the world outside one's mammalian fur. It may also be the world outside one's cell membrane. Certainly, some level of consciousness, of responsiveness owing to that awareness, is implied in all autopoietic systems. The world, after all, is not a petri dish. The sky does not rain agar. Every live being incessantly senses and responses with alacrity to its surroundings.
Mm. Absolutely. And I agree with Margulis and Sagan's conclusion from that, that consciousness is synonymous with this thing we call life. Mm. What determines the difference between life and what and non-life, or whether you even think that's at the level of the organic and the inorganic, I won't make a conclusion about that, because I think that's yet to be determined, quite frankly. If you look at the work of somebody like Stuart Kaufman, who's done very interesting work on that, and that line is not as clear as we would like to imagine. But certainly, I think it seems to me relatively uncontroversial that life is definitively, as argued here, is this capacity to sense and act.
Mm, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is, because I mean, I think this is where we can get tied into knots and about, like, you know, like, are plants conscious, or, you know, do other cells have, you know, do bacteria have some form of consciousness? But, you know, if we just define it in the capacity to sense and act, then I think the other thing that does is that it maybe puts a slightly necessary qualification on human consciousness, right? Because I think sometimes we oversell our own consciousness, and we undersell the consciousness of other cells and organisms.
Absolutely. And I think one of the ways that we do that is, and the major stumbling block, I think, of that is a sort of residue of a theological way of thinking where consciousness we're ensouled with consciousness from an external form that's donated it to us, and that puts our proximity to a sort of intellectual or an ideal projection on our behalf of what would be us in an infinitive version. And so I think there's a relatively simple solution to that. You just differentiate consciousness from self-consciousness.
Mm. Yeah.
And I think it's a little bit immaterial, to be honest, to me at this point, whether that finally ends up being a definitive differentiation.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
But it gets us out of a lot of problems now, and I think mm-hmm. that's good enough.
Sure.
You know, and... Yeah. I mean,
well, I think this is, and I think this is partly why we, you know, this is partly the problem in terms of our overestimation of our own consciousness, is that we overvalue self-consciousness, right?
Yes.
You know, so there's all these other forms of consciousness that we don't value as highly, which probably are a lot closer to the forms of consciousness that are experienced by other organisms.
Absolutely. And I think we're sort of at a point where we're starting to appreciate this, that one of the problems in our ability to try to sense this consciousness or this sort of consciousness in others is we've been looking for the same.
Mm. Mm. We've been looking for human self-consciousness.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, you know, we want to deny consciousness to a plant because... And you can state it really simply, and you can see the absurdity.
Mm.
We think a plant isn't conscious because I can walk up to a tree and say, "How are you going?" and it doesn't say anything. Right?
Right.
You know, or I get an axe and I go, "I'm going to cut you down now," and the tree doesn't move.
Mm.
Right? So I say, "It must be, therefore, it must be like a rock." Mm. Right? But... there are all sorts of ways, I guess, that we know now the sorts of the problems that are going on in that sort of reduction.
Yep.
There are differences of not just differences of morphology, but really fundamental questions about phenomenology too, which is plants have a different sensory apparatus.
Yeah.
So whatever constitutes their version of consciousness in the version of chemical and electro sensing that seems to be particular to them is just not available to us. From my understanding, you know, the tip of a plant's root is sensitive to particular molecules of phosphorus and nitrogen and makes differentiations between the two in the way that it grows. So there's that appear to be non-accidental.
Mm. Yeah.
So,
well, you know, I think this point is like that, you know, and you know, when I was talking about like the forms of consciousness that exist that might link us to other organisms, chemical sensing is one of them, right? You know, and this is a really underappreciated sense from a human point of view because we're so obsessed with our five or six senses, right?
Mm.
You know, particularly vision, and you know, when in the chemical sensing realm, we pay a little bit of attention to taste and maybe somewhat less attention to smell.
Mm.
But then there's this whole other realm of chemical sensing, which you're talking about with the root tip, right?
Yes.
You know, and I think you know that realm of chemical sensing is something that we also experience. So, you know, a simple example is like if I drink a cup of coffee, mm. right? Not only do I taste it, not only do I smell it when I'm brewing it, but then when I ingest it, those caffeine molecules, they find their way into certain receptors in my body, yes. and they change my consciousness.
They have right? a phenomenological effect.
That's exactly. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And so I'm altered through ingesting that molecule, and I'm altered in a noticeable way, in a way that rises to my consciousness.
Absolutely. Mm. And just to return quickly to the point about this sort of cascading or hierarchical effect of autopoiesis, what that also means is that the different intelligible systems or individual structures that are going on in our body, there are regimes of communication between them that we are not conscious of.
Mm.
We feel them though, or let me rephrase that. We don't have ideas of them.
Yeah.
But we're conscious of them in other ways.
Yeah,
we can be conscious of them in terms of sense impressions that are very, I'll use a term that Deleuze defined to describe this. It's sort of inexact but rigorous.
Mm.
They don't have a clear and distinct concept attached to them. I can't formulate an idea to myself that I am feel like a clear idea of feeling queasy because of a certain chemical interaction that's gone on between something that I've eaten that has a certain bacterial presence in it that's having a war with my interior bacteria that are doing other things. Mm-hmm. But I get this sort of higher diffuse response from that. There would be people who would want to reduce that just to the level of molecular interactions.
Mm-hmm.
But you would quite miss the point if you did that.
Mm.
In the same way that there are people who would want to reduce the phenomena of consciousness altogether to mechanistic interactions as well that are that don't have agency. You know, they're... It seems counterintuitive, but there is a strong current of people who, for reasons that have been well articulated logically, whether you believe them or follow them or not, I do not, but they exist and you can read all about them, that would reduce consciousness and agency entirely.
Mm.
Yes.
Just a bunch of machines. Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, this doesn't stop at Dawkins you know, the meme, you know, the sort of the genetic meme sort of transmission where we're just sort of these sophisticated conglomerates that are trying to produce, because that, not that that resolves the problem, it just reduces it.
Yeah, exactly. It's just like, it's basically just kind of bracketing out a whole lot of stuff.
Yeah,
it's like all that other stuff doesn't matter. We'll just focus on the genes that are reproducing themselves through time.
But there are people now who, you know, want to use philosophical concepts of computation and digital computation to take that down to the level of cellular automata, which is something that occurs between quantum phenomena and, you know, the emergence of matter. So, yeah.
But I think this is the
thing. Still doesn't resolve the problem.
No, it doesn't resolve the problem, and it's probably not a very good model for cellular processes either, because we're, you know, like if you treat them as binary machines, they're not binary machines. You know, when you know, like we're talking about a caffeine molecule, but actually coffee's got a whole bunch of stuff in it. It's not just a caffeine molecule, right?
Absolutely.
It's got all this other stuff in it that is all doing something in terms of a whole suite of receptors in our bodies that we don't know. Like we just don't know the level of complexity in terms of like the possible receptor interactions. And it just gets up to a point where reductive science can't approach that kind of complexity.
Yeah, it's not what it's good at. Reductive science is excellent at a range of things that are really important, but I won't be winning any friends in that camp, I think, if I suggest that most of those are designed at, and this is for me why the idea of technique is so important, what they do is they allow us to amplify our powers against nature.
Right.
That's what reductive science is particularly good at.
Yeah.
But they don't approach those sorts of metaphysical questions, you know, and you can read, you know, Karl Popper's account of this, which is far more eloquent than what I could say about this, in the way that that those limits are inscribed, and that science requires, you know, to quote, he quotes Bergson and says science needs creative intuition to produce those higher insights about what's going on. But there's no, we have to be, and talking about one of the important legacies of anthropomorphism is this thing where we allow to slip away from us just how limited our knowledge is.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's very difficult, and it's understandable. Well,
absolutely. And I think this is actually, you know, the thing. This is what is really useful about, you know, learning a little bit about biology and contemporary, you know, the contemporary biologies particularly, because, you know, like you quickly realize that this is an incredibly complex thing that's going on inside of cells and inside of our bodies. And if you start kind of delving into how the very little that we know, you can then get a sense of how much we don't know, which I think is, you know, like that's as useful as anything else, you know.
And I think, you know, and I think there's a good reason that probably my dog, for instance, doesn't have any existential dilemmas of the limits of her knowledge. And I think it's this, because I don't think she's under any illusions about what her particular intelligibility is for. That's just to make things happen.
Yeah. That was part one of my chat with Jason Tuckwell. Be sure to check out parts 2 and 3. You can find Jason Tuckwell on Twitter at Jason Tuckwell, where you'll also find a link to his blog where he has lots more information about his book. The blog is deviantechne.wordpress.com. My name is Ben Denham. You can find me on Twitter at RedwoodWord. My website is bendenham.com, where I'll be posting all of these chats. So be sure to check it out and check out my art while you're there.